Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it. Today, we have an excellent show as we dive into an area of substantive law on the privacy rights of employees using company equipment for personal use. This topic's very current and ripped from the headlines as the Supreme Court is currently examining this issue in the Kwan case. The idea for this podcast came from a live seminar I was asked to present at in Cincinnati at the law firm of Vorey, Sater, Seymour & Peace a little over a month ago, and while listening to one of their partners, Richard Moore, present on this specific issue, I thought to myself, this would make an interesting podcast and a way to thank you for having me at your presentation, Richard. So we've moved parts of that presentation into an ESI Bytes podcast. Richard Moore is a partner in the Vorey, Sater, Seymour & Peace Cincinnati office and is a member of their labor and employment group. He defends clients in federal and state court litigation arising from employment discrimination laws, the Family and Medical Leave Act, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, as well as other statutory and common law claims. He's also a member of the firm's eDiscovery core team and is a frequent lecturer and author on topics related to electronic discovery. Richard, thank you for asking me to speak at your firm's event. I'm glad that I can return the favor. Thanks for being on ESI Bytes.
Sure, glad to be here, Carl. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, and before we start, this is a new question I like to ask. First of all, how did you get started in electronic discovery? And the second part is, do you believe you can do e-discovery all by yourself?
Well, the second part I'll answer because I think that's pretty easy. No, I don't think you can do it all by yourself. I think it definitely takes a team approach, which is, I think, generally the case in all litigation. But my interest in e-discovery, I think, arose out of my general interest in technology. I had a bachelor's degree in management information systems, and have kind of played around in the area and tried to keep up with technology since graduating from undergrad. And electronic discovery was kind of a natural outflow from that interest.
Now let's get started with some of the substantive questions. First of all, how has technology impacted issues of privacy in the workplace?
I think primarily it's the ubiquitous nature of electronic communications. It's how we talk now. We use email, we blog, people are using Twitter, they have Facebook accounts, MySpace accounts, other social networking accounts that they use to communicate. So I think that's one aspect is that, the way we communicate has become electronic in nature. And as part of that, there is this reality that in electronic communication, unlike communication over the phone, there's a trail that's left behind. So where the phone conversation kind of evaporates into the ether after we hang up the phone, in the electronic communications, specifically with respect to email or other communications over the internet or using data networks, those communications leave a trail behind. And as a result, there's increased issues around privacy as people may access that trail that's left behind. Certainly, it was possible to tape record phone calls, but that, there were established laws that prohibited that, and that was not, a common practice unless someone was under some type of criminal investigation. But in the area of electronic communications, I think we're seeing more and more of that. And I think a lot of people don't appreciate that distinction. They're not as cautious as they may otherwise be in using company data networks to conduct private business.
It's sort of related, but not exactly on point. I was reading some of the internet headlines this weekend, and there was a unfortunate young lady who had a blog post online in her private time, off work. She kept everything separate. But it was about, her feelings on sex. And, she just posted a Twitter post, a couple posts, and wasn't aware when she put her name in, even though she used the handle, that her name showed up. Her company did a Google search, and within 10 seconds had all these hits about her views on sex and fired her, right after that. I don't know why these things intersect with sex so much, but you know, online tools and sex generally don't work well with employment. I think we could make a black letter law on that.
I think that's right. You know, it is interesting. I don't know if this is human nature or not, but it seems like technology is first used to promote religion and sex. Is the one that's close behind. I think who was it? The Guggenheim Press. I just imagine after they finished the Bible, they were starting to generate some right food drawings. It was probably the thing to come off of it.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. And again, I think that I think this may be changing slowly, but I don't think that people, you know, who grow up using blogs and Facebook and other social networking accounts really have a true appreciation of the permanent nature of these communications. And, you know, things you may say as a high school student may follow you the rest of your life because they'll you know, continue to float around in the internet.
ESI Bytes has started and will always remain a PG-rated program, okay? Because I'm aware of that. All right, well, let's talk about company networks. Who owns the data on company networks?
Well, generally the company does. And I say generally because there are a few cases out there that have found that employees did have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to information stored on company networks. But I think that the majority of cases conclude that the company owns the data on its network, and that's especially true if companies have policies in place that make that clear to employees. And I think one of the themes that hopefully will come out of this discussion is that it is critical that companies have these types of policies in place to make sure that their employees understand that the data on its networks is data that's owned by the company, and it's also data that can be accessed by the company.
And it seems like one of the key phrases is reasonable expectation of privacy. Do employees have a reasonable expectation of privacy regarding information on their work computers?
Well, that's a good question, and I have to say it depends. And I say it depends because there are cases that are starting to kind of percolate up that have been a little more lenient or a little more restrictive in terms of finding against companies with respect to expectations of privacy. You know, if we'd have had this conversation maybe a year or two ago, I would have said, absolutely, companies have the right to access the employees' data, and employees don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But in the cases that have found that employees do have expectations of privacy, generally you don't have a clear-cut company policy that dictates that the company will monitor the electronic communications and access employee communications. And in those cases, courts have found that there may be a reasonable expectation of privacy in the use of the company computers.
Plus, I'm a part of a local networking group with some corporate people involved, and one of the trends that some of them have been saying is happening is companies are requiring employees to buy their own computers. They'll give them a stipend. But to reduce the costs and IT costs of maintaining, they let the employee use their own computer, which they partially or fully pay for. I mean, these lines are going to get blurred more and more with that type of if that turns into a trend.
Absolutely, and I think that's a tricky situation because I think companies absolutely need to keep track of employees' electronic communications to protect themselves against claims of harassment or hostile work environment and even trade secret violations that may be occurring with electronic communications. And if you're blurring that line even more, it really makes it tricky in terms of accessing some of that information or from the employee's standpoint, protecting themselves and their private communications.
Well, under what circumstances would an employer need to access an employee's private information?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's ever a circumstance where the company would need to access the private information, but I think what happens in most instances is the company gains access to the information through either routine monitoring or if there's an investigation that may be occurring as part of some other unrelated activity. For instance, if the employee sues the company for discrimination as part of their electronic discovery preservation and collection efforts, the company may access that employee's laptop and find personal information that's stored on there. Again, technology is such that even if an employee, let's say for example, an employee is using a Hotmail account, not storing their or transmitting their email through the company email account, but is accessing their account using company computers, but the email is actually stored and processed through a third party like Hotmail or Gmail or something like that. Well, you know, the computer may retain some of those communications. The company computer may have some of the residue from those communications, and the company may access that information. And that's occurred in a couple cases.
Well, what risks do employers face?
Well, I think primarily invasion of privacy claims. If an employer does go over the line, or it's not clear where the line is, they could face an invasion of privacy claim. There are also some federal statutes like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act or the Stored Communication Act that limit or restrict a third party from accessing others' electronic communication. And where that really, I think, is going to increasingly come into play is this, the use of cloud computing. As I mentioned, if an employee has a Hotmail or Gmail account and they use the company computer to access it, they may leave behind information on those accounts. And that's happened in a case where it was a trade secret case. It was a fitness firm. And one of the employees left the firm to start their own competing company. And as part of the investigation, the company was able to find information regarding this employee's Hotmail account, for instance, the password and username. They used that information to then access that account. Well, the court found that that was a violation of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And the company said, the company tried to argue, well, our policy is clear that information on our systems belongs to the company. And the court said that's ridiculous. That's like saying that because you found someone's key in their desk drawer that now you have access to their home. And so companies have to be careful not to go, not to step over the line in terms of violating those statutes, because they're both criminal and civil sanctions that are associated with it. But there's also general risk with respect to claims of discrimination or retaliation if the company is not enforcing these policies consistently. Employees also have protection under the National Labor Relations Act for some activity regarding the conditions of their employment. So companies have to tread lightly in this area, especially with respect. I think most recently, the New Jersey Supreme Court found that an employee did not waive their attorney-client privilege just because they used the company's computers to access or to communicate with their attorney regarding a potential claim. And that's really, I think, a cautionary tale, because with respect to electronic discovery, attorneys have to make sure that they're abiding by the rules of professional conduct with respect to accessing attorney-client privileged information, even if it's stored on a company computer. So all those areas are areas that employers face potential risk.
Well, it looks like both sides need to take steps to protect themselves. First, what do employers need to do to protect themselves? And then why don't we look at the employees?
Well, from the employer side, I think, again, the policy is really the first step in protecting themselves. And the policies have to be clear. They have to make sure that they specify that not only does the company have the right to monitor the electronic communications, but they will monitor the electronic communications. And it's also important that these policies provide the employees that these policies provide consent from the employees for the employer to monitor the electronic communication, because that protects the employee employer from violations of the Electronic Communications Act or Stored Communications Act, and it also can protect the employee from invasion of privacy claims. And these policies, as I mentioned, have to make sure that they make it clear that employees should not have any expectation of privacy with respect to their electronic communications on the company systems. And these policies have to be enforced uniformly. You can't have a written policy that says one thing and an informal policy that says something else. And they have to also be enforced across the board. I mean, you can't enforce them only when, say, for instance, a union steward is using the company email to communicate with union members and not enforce it against other employees who are using it for non-business uses. And obviously it has to be enforced without regard to an individual's protected class. So some of the same things that occur in any employee policy enforcement also apply with respect to electronic communications policies.
You know, it seems to me like the lawyers always fight this impossible battle to win against human nature. And the first line of defense is the policy. Okay, put a policy in place. But, you know, there's so many examples where policies are hard to enforce. Records management is one area where people don't do what they're supposed to do with storing data. Another one is, you know, giving references to people.
Right.
You know, LinkedIn is a reference farm. And you may have policies all over the place, but on the line, people are you know, violate them. You know, can you turn a policy into Swiss cheese by the conduct of your people on the line?
Absolutely, and we'll talk about this in more detail. But the Kwan case that you mentioned in the introduction is a prime example of that. The city of Ontario, California, had a written policy that was explicit in explaining that people should not have an expectation of privacy, and that the city would monitor the use of these electronic communications. But, you know, down the line, that policy was voided because they had an informal policy that was adopted that the court found trumped the written policy. So, you know, that is a problem. It's a continual problem. It's a problem in not only electronic communications, but any employment policy where you have, you know, absenteeism or tardiness policies that may not be enforced uniformly, that always create problems when you end up disciplining somebody who claims that, you know, you did it for an unlawful reason. And they can bring up examples of other people who weren't disciplined for similar actions. So that's a continuing problem.
Yeah.
You know, companies have to, I think another important piece of the policies is not a static document. I mean, once it's in place, it has to be continually monitored to make sure that not only keeps up with technology, but also keeps up with reality in terms of what is actually going on the ground in the company.
And I interrupted you before you got a chance to say what employees can do to protect themselves.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think primarily employees need to recognize that they're being watched, or at least assume that they're being watched, and not do anything on the company's computers that they wouldn't do in real life. And you know, not transmit anything electronically that they wouldn't want the company or their boss to know about. And I think employees need to have an appreciation. I mean, you don't necessarily need to understand the details of the technology, but just have an appreciation that, you know, electronic communication leaves a trail behind. It doesn't evaporate like a phone call when you hang up the phone. And so you have to be cautious and careful in terms of what you communicate, especially through the company's computers.
Why not just restrict a computer use to business use only?
You know, I don't, and that is certainly a way that companies can further protect themselves, but I just don't think in this day and age that that's a practical solution. I mean, people use the Internet for personal use. They communicate personal messages via email, and, you know, from a employee morale standpoint, it may not be a good idea to say you absolutely can't use our system for any other communication, because as you point out, people are going to find a workaround. That may mean that they have to get up from their from their desk and use their smartphone in the break room or downstairs to make arrangements for somebody to pick up their kid from soccer practice at the end of the day, as opposed to being able to just send a quick email from their desk. But I think technology can be a good way to help with that, and specifically using technology to block certain internet sites or block social networking sites that really could be problematic in the workplace. So I think the realities of kind of how we function today make a business use only policy impractical. Now, companies could look at limiting it to particular times of day. You can use it on your break or at lunch, something like that. But I think a complete ban would be difficult to enforce.
I think we talked a little bit about this at the beginning about the questions about what about activities outside of work can employees be disciplined. And I guess the sex blogger in St. Louis is a good example of the at-will doctrine. But do you have anything else you want to add on that? Or
well, there are a couple states that do have laws on the books that prohibit companies from taking disciplinary action against employees for engaging in lawful activity, for example, smoking or consuming alcoholic beverages. Political activity may also be covered under some of the statutes. So employers have to be careful if they live in a state that has one of those statutes on the books. But most states are employment at will states, so employers can take action or terminate employees for any reason as long as it's not discriminatory or illegal. And that's where the real rub is, because you may come across information in monitoring an employee's, especially their off-work activity, that you may otherwise not know, that may bring them under a protected class. And one example that comes to mind is disability. If an employee is blogging about a psychiatric condition they're suffering from, and you see that, and subsequently, whether related or not, you take action against that employee, that may support a claim that there is a violation of the Americans with Disability Act, because you knew that they were suffering from a serious medical condition and you took an adverse employment action against them, or you perceived that they were because they were communicating on this blog. So it could be a tricky area for employers. And I mentioned the National Labor Relations Act. That act protects concerted activity, specifically activity related to the terms and conditions of employment. So if a employee is blogging about the conditions of their employment, for instance, the insufficient break times or insufficient wages, and a employer takes action against them, they may find themselves on the other side of a charge of violating the National Labor Relations Act. So those are some examples of areas that employers need to be careful about.
Now, we talked touched on earlier some of the risks the employers face for monitoring electronic communication outside of work. You mentioned some of the statutes. How have the courts been handling these issues?
Well, it's kind of in flux now, but generally the courts look to the policies of that are in place by the companies in terms of evaluating whether or not there's this reasonable expectation of privacy. I mentioned the New Jersey Supreme Court case. In that case, the company policy said that there should be no expectation of privacy, but the court held that the attorney-client privilege trumps that policy, that when you're talking about attorney-client communications, that is held sacrosanct in the law, and that any policy that would allow an employer to access their employees' communications with their attorney is unenforceable. But there are other cases that come down on the other side, that if you have a policy that clearly states that there's no expectation of privacy, and you communicate with your attorney using that their system, then you waive that attorney-client privilege. So, as I said, I think the courts generally are in flux now, but I think it's pretty consistent that the jumping off point in courts evaluating some of these issues is with respect to what policy was in place.
Well, the courts being in flux, it's no wonder the Supreme Court's looking at this now. So, has the Supreme Court, to what extent have they examined this issue, and where are we with the Supreme Court?
Well, it's interesting because a couple of weeks ago they heard oral argument in this Kwan case that you mentioned. And this case involved a police officer for the city of Ontario, California. The city had issued two-way pagers to his police officers. And the written policy in that case explained that there's no expectation of privacy, we're going to monitor your communications, and basically that's what the policy laid out. But the Officer Kwan's lieutenant had adopted a informal policy, and what he said is as long as you pay for any overage over our allotted number of text messages, I'm not going to be bothered with monitoring your text communication, your text messages. And Kwan, paid for overages a couple of times, and the city had monitored his text communications. Well, the city decided to monitor his text communications and found that he had these, sex rears his ugly head. It had these explicit communications that were sexual in nature with his wife and his mistress. And Kwan sued, saying that there was an invasion of privacy, a violation of the Fourth Amendment, because you had a state actor involved. And the Supreme Court is granted cert with respect to the city's appeal, because the lower courts found that there was, in fact, an invasion of privacy, that Kwan had a reasonable expectation of privacy because of this informal policy that had been adopted. It's unclear, obviously, what the Supreme Court's going to do at this point. But, one of the key factors in that case, I think, is the fact that you had a written policy that said one thing, but an informal policy that said another. And that, regardless of what the Supreme Court says, I think is a cautionary note to all employers that they have to, as I mentioned, be consistent in their application. Another interesting thing about the Kwan case is that the court took a pretty strict the lower courts at least took a pretty strict interpretation of the city's policy. And the policy as written did not include two-way pagers, because the technology hadn't been developed at the time that the policy was written. And so one of the factors that the court considered was that these electronic two-way pagers were not covered by the policy. So again, employers have to be careful and have to make sure that they periodically review their policies and make sure they're keeping up with technology.
Yeah, and this case appeared on a top 10 list that we did at the beginning of the year with the SI Bites of Ron Hedges, and it's clearly one of the will be one of the most important decisions this year for e-discovery. So we'll all have our eyes on that one.
And it'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court does, because one of the important distinctions in this case is that you have a state actor involved, you have a city involved, so you have constitutional Fourth Amendment issues that are probably going to predominate the court's analysis. Depending on how broad their analysis is, there'll be a question of how much this will apply to private employers.
Well, let's sort of wrap up the show talking a little bit about some of the e-discovery implications from all this, the whole area of privacy, and what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think the primary area where e-discovery is impacted is in terms of this potential invasion of privacy, because in the identification and collection of electronic information, you may stumble across information that is private in nature, and especially in the area of attorney-client communications. The case I mentioned where the company found communications between the employee and her lawyer. One of the issues in that case is that the attorneys involved have an obligation under the ethical rules to notify the other side that they've accessed these privileged communications, and attorneys have to be careful that they don't find themselves on the wrong side of an ethical claim, because they they don't follow the appropriate steps if they do come across this information. But generally, you have questions in terms of potential exposure for invasion of privacy claims. Just like in Quan, when they conducted the audit, it was to determine, it wasn't to determine whether or not he had been texting inappropriate messages. It was to determine who should pay the bill, and they came across this clearly very private communications, and Quan filed suit for invasion of privacy. So in the process of collecting data from corporate networks, it's probably inevitable that you're going to stumble across some information that should be considered private, and there's going to be a real question in terms of how to protect the company.
The other thing that I see in this space is the introduction of new tools. We've talked about the cloud a little bit, is largely fueled by people experimenting with all these largely free social media sites that are out there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
companies are slow to experiment because of the network implications, and they want to make sure they understand. People aren't.
and companies have to be careful because, again, if they stumble across a username or password that could open the door to, a cloud account that cloud email account that someone has, or other access of a web page, and they use that information, they could again find themselves in violation of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Or if they friend someone on Facebook under false pretenses, again, you may have the same exposure. So companies have to tread carefully.
Well, this has been very, very interesting. I want to thank you, Richard, for joining us on the CSI Bytes show, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later in the year.
Okay, glad to do it. I appreciate it, Carl.
And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com, ESI Bytes, for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bytes, VSI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.